India has been the scene of mass anti-government protests since September. This after the government of Prime Minister Narendra Modi introduced a reform bill which was later passed into law seeking to deregulate India's agricultural sector by setting a minimum support price known as MSP and allowing farmers to sell their crops to private buyers. Protesters, however, have a different understanding of the law. They accuse the government of Modi's Bharatiya Janata Party of aiming to benefit big corporations, leaving farmers at the mercy of a free market while they can sell crops at higher prices if the demand is there. They have called on all farmers to hold sit-in protests outside district offices throughout the country.
I think they wonder if the farmers say that they need minimum guarantee of income. Obviously, they have a point. That's my opinion. That they have a point in saying that we want minimum guarantee of income, otherwise we will suffocate and we will die.
On Monday, protest leaders and community organizers called for demonstrations to be held in all districts across the entire nation. They also intensified their agitation by calling on demonstrators to start a day-long hunger strike. In many of such events, protests have turned violent with police using military tactics, including water cannons and tear gas, against frustrated protesters to disperse them. Some were also beaten with batons. The law allows farmers to sell their produce outside government-controlled agricultural markets, which ensures prices wouldn't get too high. Modi says this will give farmers a chance to decide their own prices and sell directly to private businesses like grocery chains, which ultimately cut the traders and middlemen.
The amount of money that the farmers are going to lose is unbelievable, because if they allow these, what we call, free market enterprises to get into this place and get rid of the farmers, small industry farmers.
Yet several rounds of negotiations between the government and protest leaders have had no tangible result. The farmers want authorities to completely repeal the law. Even a written proposal to the farmers' union, which laid out a series of amendments, including written assurances over MSP, has not stopped farmers from calling off their protests. Farmers say the amendments are just part of cosmetic changes to the law and it does not really change its character. They say the only way left for the farmers is to continue their protests until their demands are met. Agriculture contributes more than 15% of India's GDP, making it the largest employment source and a significant piece of its overall socio-economic development. It has employed 49% of its total workforce, that accounts for more than half of the country's working population. According to Hindustan Times, from 2018 to 2019, the average Indian farmer earned 10,329 rupees, which is about $140 per month. Of more than 263 million workers, many solely rely on farming to put food on their table and roof over their head. Based on figures released by India's Ministry of Commerce and Industry, the country is the world's largest producer, consumer, and exporter of spices, producing nearly 70% of the world's spices. It is also the world's largest milk producer and the second largest rice and wheat producer after China.
The thing is, Modi government doesn't realize that it's an agricultural economy that basically they have. But since they have progressed so much, they think that they are able to, what you call, get rid of those laws and give the industry, the so-called free market. In that doesn't work in case of this sort of situation as it is. The farmers say they want minimum guarantees. The Modi government is not able to, so far, is unwilling to give them those tools.
The crisis in the agricultural sector in India is nothing new, as the country has been suffering for decades. Things changed significantly in the 1960s when India went through the Green Revolution under then Prime Minister Indira Gandhi, who implemented the growth of high-yielding wheat and rice crops to address famine in the country. The revolution marked the beginning of industrializing the agricultural sector and introduced new methods of fertilization and the use of pesticides, which negatively affected many farmers. Now with the new law, nothing can be guaranteed except growing inequalities and disparity among the Indian population. The crisis will also leave one of the world's largest economies in tatters.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In the midst of the greatest health emergency in modern times, with more than 4 million surgical procedures delayed by the National Health Service, Britain has announced a record increase of £16.5 billion in so-called defense spending. But these billions are not for defense. Britain has no enemies other than those within who betray the trust of its ordinary people, its nurses and doctors, its carers, elderly, homeless, and youth, as successive neoliberal governments have done. Conservative and Labour, says John Pilger, journalist and writer, in an article published under the heading, "The most lethal virus is not COVID, it is war." Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. Britain's Armed Services Memorial is a silent hunting place. Set in the rural beauty of Staffordshire in an arboretum of some 30,000 trees and sweeping lawns, its Homeric figures celebrate determination and sacrifice. The names of more than 16,000 British servicemen and women are listed. The literature says they died in operational theater or war targeted by terrorists. Malaya, Ireland, Kenya, Hong Kong, Libya, Iraq, Palestine, and many more, including secret operations such as Indochina. Not a year has passed since peace was declared in 1945 that Britain has not sent military forces to fight the wars of empire. Not a year has passed when countries mostly poor and riven by conflict have not bought or have been soft loan British arms to feather the wars or interests of empire. Empire? What empire? The investigative journalist Phil Miller recently revealed in Declassified that Boris Johnson's Britain maintained 145 military sites, called them bases, in 42 countries. Johnson has boasted that Britain is to be the foremost naval power in Europe. In the midst of the greatest health emergency in modern times, with more than 4 million surgical procedures delayed by the National Health Service, Johnson has announced a record increase of £16.5 billion in so-called defense spending, a figure that would restore the under-resourced NHS many times over. But these billions are not for defense. Britain has no enemies other than those within who betray the trust of its ordinary people, its nurses and doctors, its carers, elderly, homeless, and youth, as successive neoliberal governments have done, Conservative and Labour. Pilger said, "Exploring the security of the National War Memorial, I soon realized there was not a single monument or plinth or plaque or rosebush honoring the memory of Britain's victims, the civilians in the peacetime operations commemorated here. There is no remembrance of the Libyans killed when their country was willfully destroyed by Prime Minister David Cameron and his collaborators in Paris and Washington. There is no word of regret for the Serbian women and children killed by British bombs, dropped from a safe height on schools, factories, bridges, towns, on the orders of Tony Blair, or for the impoverished Yemeni children extinguished by Saudi regime pilots, with their logistics and targets supplied by Britons in the air-conditioned safety of Riyadh, or for the Syrians starved by sanctions. There is no monument to the Palestinian children murdered with the British elite's enduring connivance, such as the recent campaign that destroyed a modest reform movement within the Labour Party with the specious accusations of anti-Semitism. 2 weeks ago, the Zionist regime's military chief of staff and Britain's chief of the defense staff signed an agreement to formalize and enhance military cooperation. This was not new. More British arms and logistical support will now flow to the fake and lawless regime in Tel Aviv, whose snipers target children and psychopaths interrogate children in extreme isolation. Perhaps the most striking omission at the Staffordshire War Memorial is an acknowledgement of the million Iraqis whose lives and country were destroyed by the illegal invasion of Blair and Bush in 2003. ORB, a member of the British Polling Council, put the figure at 1.2 million. In 2013, the Congress organization asked a cross-section of the British public how many Iraqis had died in the invasion. A majority said fewer than 10,000. Such a lethal silence sustained in a sophisticated society? The answer is that propaganda is far more effective in societies that regard themselves as free than in dictatorships and autocracies, include censorship by omission. Western propaganda industries, both political and cultural, including most of the media, are the most powerful and refined on earth. Big lies can be repeated incessantly in comforting BBC voices. Omissions are no problem. A similar question relates to nuclear war, whose threat is of no interest, to quote Harold Pinter. In South Korea, a missile system known as Terminal High Altitude Air Defense, or THAAD, is aimed point blank at China across the narrow East China Sea. Russia, a nuclear power, is encircled by the war-making group known as NATO, with British troops regularly maneuvering right up to the border where Hitler invaded. Pilger said, "A few years after the invasion of Iraq, I made a film called The War You Don't See, in which I asked leading American and British journalists, as well as TV news executives, people I knew as colleagues, why and how Bush and Blair were allowed to get away with the great crime in Iraq, considering that the lies were not very clever. Their response surprised me. Had we, they said, that is journalists and broadcasters, especially in the US, challenged the claims of the White House and Downing Street, investigated and exposed the lies, instead of amplifying and echoing them, the invasion of Iraq in 2003 probably would not have happened. Countless people would be alive today, for 1 million refugees would not have fled. The grisly Daesh, a product of the Blair-Bush invasion, might not have been conceived." David Rose then, with the London Observer, which supported the invasion, described the peak of lies fed to me by a fairly sophisticated disinformation campaign. Raghe Elmah, then the BBC's man in Iraq, told me we failed to press the most uncomfortable buttons hard enough. Dan Rather, the CBS anchorman, agreed, as did many others. I admired these journalists who broke the silence, but they are honorable exceptions. Today, the war drums have new and highly enthusiastic beaters in Britain, America, and the Western world. COVID has provided cover for this pandemic of propaganda. In July, Morrison took his cue from Trump and announced that Australia, which has no enemies, would spend $270 billion on provoking one, including missiles that could reach China. The Australian media cheered almost as one, delivering a shower of abuse at China. Thousands of Chinese students who had guaranteed the gross salaries of Australian vice chancellors were advised by the government to go elsewhere. Colonial racism is never hard to revive. In a part of the article, Pilger added, "Some years ago, I interviewed the former head of the CIA in Latin America, Duan Clarage. In a few refreshingly honest words, he summed up Western foreign policy as it is ordained and directed by Washington. The superpower, he said, could do what it wanted, where it wanted, whenever its strategic interests dictated. His words were, 'Get used to it, world.' I have reported a number of wars. I have seen the remains of children and women and the elderly bombed and burned to death. Their villages laid to waste. Their petrified trees festooned with human parts and much else. Perhaps that is why I reserve a specific contempt for those who promote the crime of rapacious war, who beckon it with bad faith and profanities, having never experienced it themselves. Their monopoly must be broken."
European News Bulletin.
Thanks for joining us, everyone. My name is Saeed Puriza. Our top story: a new variant of the COVID-19 virus has caused major concern across Europe, forcing the British government to scrap the 5-day Christmas break and prompting European countries to bar Britons trying to get away at the last minute. Initially, France banned all freight from the UK as well, but amid fears of food shortages, the French government says it'll establish a protocol to ensure movement from the UK can resume. Bianca Rahimi has our report.
The news was delivered Saturday that the southeast and east of England, including the capital London, were descending into Tier 4 COVID-19 restrictions. This was sparked by the discovery of a new variant of the virus that is up to 70% more transmittable.
Given the early evidence we have on this new variant of the virus, the potential risk it poses, it is with a very heavy heart, I must tell you, we cannot continue with Christmas as planned. In England, those living in Tier 4 areas should not mix with anyone outside their own household at Christmas, though support bubbles will remain in place for those at particular risk of loneliness or isolation.
After the announcement, chaos ensued as people scrambled to leave ahead of the midnight deadline. People bundled up presents and essentials and set out hoping to save their Christmas plans after England's Chief Medical Officer Chris Whitty suggested they unpack.
I want to put some numbers out there because I think that helps to explain why I'm going to give the answer that I'm going to give. But my short answer would be, please unpack it at this stage.
Officials say that the ban on Tier 4 Christmas visits is unenforceable. And to make things worse, hundreds of flights were cancelled after the UK's closest allies cut transport with it due to fears about the new COVID-19 strain. The decision meant closing off the UK's most important artery with mainland Europe, a step British Transport Minister Grant Shapps said was surprising, especially as, according to him, the new strain is already in continental Europe.
We tend to be more aware of the variants faster. And there have been thousands of variants of coronavirus. It's just that the particular one that we've seen in Kent and London, the thing which has led to the Tier 4 lockdown, is a particularly virulent variant of the virus. So it means that it spreads more easily. We've detected that first, but we know already that the cases have been found in continental Europe and other countries.
The chaos hit just days before the United Kingdom was due to exit the EU's orbit with or without a trade deal. Brexit negotiators Michel Barnier and Lord Frost met in Brussels Sunday, but yet again, an agreement was not reached. In view of the situation, Brexit negotiations could be extended. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Following weeks of intensive talks, the head of the EU's Brexit group, David McAllister, has announced there was still no clarity on whether the EU and UK would reach a Brexit trade agreement. EU chief negotiator Michel Barnier and his UK counterpart David Frost met in Brussels Sunday but didn't find agreement. With 10 days to go before the UK formally leaves the EU, key issues around trade competition and fishing remain unresolved. At the same time, Scotland's First Minister Nicola Sturgeon has urged the UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson to seek an extension to the Brexit transition period in light of new restrictions brought on by Britain's COVID crisis. All right, let's talk about those two stories with Chris Bambury, who's an author and political commentator, joining me now. Thanks for coming onto the show. Before we get to Brexit negotiations, I want to get your opinion, your reaction on the screeching U-turn by the Prime Minister on Saturday on Christmas rules.
I think it was a chaotic reversal by Boris Johnson. And I say that because it's become clear that they were aware of this new variant of COVID-19 for a considerable period of time, and the cases were rising. You could read that in the daily briefings on what's happening in London and the South East. And therefore, I think it should have happened much earlier, allowing people not to have to rip up their Christmas plans, which is what's happened in the final days of this most important holiday of the year, and causing a lot of bitterness. So I think this is just once again a sign of the incompetence of the Johnson government. Really, this is something that should have been implemented much earlier. And it could have been very clear that, you know, this new variant had arrived and it was based in the southeast of London and numbers were growing fast, which you could read, which you could be aware of. And therefore, we had to move to a lockdown well before the date that was announced, allowing people to make plans for the holiday and not having to rip them up at the last minute or trying to scrabble onto a flight or a train or whatever to get out of London before midnight.
Yeah, Labour leader called it gross negligence, and that the alarm bells have been ringing for some time, just to borrow a phrase from the Labour leader. Now, a lot has happened since. More than 40 countries have banned arrivals from the UK. There seems to be that this decision is taking on more and more, let's say, ramifications to it.
I think there's two things here. I think the decision to stop people coming in from the UK on flights, etc., I think that's understandable. Although I do agree with what's said in the package, that the new variant is in continental Europe, but actually further away in Australia and elsewhere. I think the decision of France to shut the port, essentially access from the port of Dover to Europe, not allowing freight in, I think most people in Britain will see that as connected to the Brexit talks. And whether right or wrongly, they'll see that Emmanuel Macron, who's one of the hawks in the whole Brexit process, have implemented that, if you like, as revenge for the whole Brexit thing, whole Brexit vote. And therefore, I think it's going to lead, at a time when people are already upset about what's happened with the Christmas holidays, now we're hearing talk of food shortages, etc., it's only going to add to the anguish of what people here are feeling at a very sensitive moment. And it seems to me that France taking that decision really was very, very bad PR, at the least.
Right. We're expecting to hear from the British Prime Minister in the coming hour, I guess, and we'll see what he has to say about it all. But talking about Brexit now, do you think at this point a transition period being extended is inevitable?
I think Boris Johnson has a real problem with this because his own backbenchers, the Brexit backbenchers, are going to oppose that. As they report, they basically want a no deal because they fear that in this negotiations, the government will give ground overfishing and other things in particular. So among his Brexiteer backbenches, there will be bitter opposition to this. And many of these are the same people who oppose the imposition of the tier system over COVID, this current lockdown as well. So I think Johnson is caught as the champion of Brexit. The other factor which is breaking here is that there is a general sense, I think, that the United Kingdom is beginning to come apart. You know, when you discover the parallel negotiation over with Gibraltar over allowing the Schengen Agreement to be in place for freedom of labour, yes, Gibraltar is not part of the UK, but it's no UK overseas territory. Then we've had this deal in the island of Ireland, which seems to be allowing free trade across the border without any restrictions, and the situation in Scotland, which you might come on to, with the Scottish Government arguing that there should be this deal. There is a sense that the United Kingdom is really beginning to edge apart here. And I think Johnson must be aware he doesn't want that as his political legacy, the man who broke up the United Kingdom.
It's only a matter of time, I think. We'll see how things will transfer as we move forward in the coming months. Thank you very much, Chris Bambury, author and commentator. Thanks for joining the program. And now let's have a look at some other news this hour. Two men have been found guilty of the manslaughter of 39 men, women, and children from Vietnam after they were found dead in the back of a truck near London last year. The refugees, aged 15 to 44, were sealed inside for at least 12 hours in temperatures that rose above 38 degrees Celsius. The two drivers, 24-year-old Amon Harrison and 43-year-old Jorge Nica, were found guilty of 39 counts of manslaughter and one count of assisting in unlawful immigration in a case which shone light on the perilous journeys undertaken by refugees to reach European shores. At least 10 people have died following the outbreak of a fire inside a hospital's intensive care unit in Turkey. State-run news agency Anadolu News says the fire started when an oxygen cylinder exploded inside a unit for COVID-19 patients. The victims are reportedly aged between 56 and 85. The country's health minister said he was deeply saddened by the tragedy and that an investigation was underway. Five people have been injured following the collapse of a residential building in the Portuguese capital, Lisbon. The building collapsed after a fire started inside it. The five injured were whisked off to a nearby hospital as firefighters battled the flames. The local fire department has said two people were still unaccounted for. The cause of the fire is yet to be known.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we covered the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
In this segment, a massive drug bust in Italy, with Italian police claiming the 14 tons of captagon originated from Syria and were destined for Libya. Well, let's bring in Ahmed Caballo to break it down for us. Ahmed, tell us why you picked this story.
It's a fascinating report by the BBC. They make some very big allegations about captagon, which is an amphetamine drug that's used to increase alertness, boost concentration, and boost confidence on the battlefield. Now, they claim that the Syrian government and Hezbollah are responsible for distributing billions of pounds worth of this drug.
This is not the first time, Ahmed, a report like that is made. Any evidence presented by the reporter there?
No evidence at all. So the report is short. It's about 2 minutes 30. I'd advise our viewers to go on the BBC website to check it out. He makes these big claims. He gives no evidence. In fact, the logic for his argument is because it comes from quote-unquote Syrian-controlled or Syrian government-controlled areas, that it means that Syrian government is involved as well as its allies, the Islamic Resistance Movement, Hezbollah. But that argument makes no sense. That's like saying if drugs are found in London, which is British government-controlled areas, that means the British government is involved. So it doesn't make any sense. And what's worrying is the BBC raises its flag of being impartial in all of its output, yet it's failed on its impartiality with this report. Now, we've got a tweet from Children of the Dust. He says, BS, nothing in this video proves that the substance is meth or that Assad is associated with it. Syria is not America's problem. CIA, degenerate. Now, we've got another video from John Stockwell. He's a former CIA operations officer. He explains how journalists work with intelligence communities and what they do to disseminate propaganda.
Another thing is to disseminate propaganda to influence people's minds. And this is a major function of the CIA. And unfortunately, of course, it overlaps into the gathering of information. You have contact with a journalist, you will give him true stories, you'll get information from him, you'll also give him false stories.
Straight from the horse's mouth goes the expression, Ahmed.
Yeah, and this is an interesting report, because if you watch the report, the BBC reporter, Quinton Somerville, he's given exclusive access. He even holds the drug, which is allegedly evidence, and he's playing around with it, and then he's there when the drugs are destroyed. And you wonder, why is he given such access? Possibly because the Italian government, the European Union, and Western governments are working hand in glove with organizations like the BBC to paint a certain image of the Syrian government, of the Islamic resistance movement, Hezbollah. Now, final tweet on this, Lee Camp from Redacted says this: the war on drugs achieves domestically what the war on terror has achieved internationally. Under the guise of dealing with the problem, the US government can arrest and kill hundreds of thousands in order to control populations that pose an issue for the empire. And what we've seen with Syria is it's been demonized in the war on terror, but it has that propaganda hasn't worked. Most people recognize that the Syrian government has been fighting terrorists in Syria, and now they've changed their propaganda operation, and now they're trying to make them seem as some sort of drug dealing cartel. Right. Yet they're making these allegations without any evidence, and that's why people online are not buying it.
Okay, let's move on to your second story. The U.S. Congress voting $4 billion of American taxpayer money in aid to Israel in 2021.
Yeah, so this is an interesting story because it was part of the United States Congress approving the National Defense Bill, which was $740 billion worth of U.S. military budget. Now, what's interesting about this story is it got bipartisan approval. There wasn't a big deal made of it in the press. At the same time, the COVID relief bill to give Americans relief during a health pandemic was debated on in the Congress and was left down to the wire before it was passed. And when it was passed, they agreed to give Americans $600, that's right, $600 one-off payment, which is not even enough to pay their rent. And some are asking, why is it that American taxpayers can pay for the welfare of Israeli citizens, yet Americans have a health pandemic in which over 300,000 people have died, over 17 million people have been infected, there isn't the relief needed. Now, we've got a tweet from If Americans Know. It says, Congress votes $4 billion to aid to Israel in 2021. Press don't tell Americans about the massive aid to Israel, a tiny entity with a long record of human rights abuses, violations of law, systematic racism, and damage to Americans. Maria says, meanwhile, and then after this tweet, she plays a video of homeless people that we're going to play. Now, in this video, you can see, obviously, homeless people struggling in the United States. And this is coming at a time where Jimmy Dore, the American comedian, has tried to push progressives to push the Nancy Pelosi, the House Speaker, to pass a motion or to have a vote on Medicare for All. Now, the U.S. doesn't have universal health care, yet Israel does have universal health care. And some are asking, why are American taxpayers paying for Israeli citizens to have benefits that are not even afforded to U.S. citizens?
Valid question, Ahmed, indeed, that question that people are asking. Ahmed Caballo with those stories for us. Ahmed, thanks as always. Let's have a look at some other stories now. Europeans are set to start getting coronavirus vaccines before the new year after the regional drug regulator accelerated its approval process following the launch of immunization campaigns in the U.S. and Britain. The European Medicines Agency has begun the evaluation process for the vaccine made by U.S. company Pfizer and German partner BioNTech. Germany, France, Italy, and five other European states will coordinate the start of their vaccination campaigns, with plans in place to incorporate the rest of the bloc as a second wave of the virus forces regional and national lockdowns over the festive period. Well, speaking of festive periods, Pope Francis has led his final Sunday address of the year at St. Peter's Square in the Vatican and touched on the celebration of Christmas in the modern age.
Brothers and sisters, consumerism has kidnapped Christmas, taking it away from us. There is no consumerism in the manger in Bethlehem. What is there is reality, poverty, and love.
The pontiff also spoke about the evolving celebrations during the COVID pandemic and asked followers to visit the various nativity scenes around St. Peter's Square. Let's bring you two more social media stories that have been trending. Number one, troubling scenes captured by the body cam on a police sergeant in the U.S. city of Boston, showing him bragging about using his vehicle to hit people during the racial justice protests over the summer. Richard Sudan joins me now with all the details. Richard, what has changed since last time we heard about this?
So this is a quite incredible story, which I think is very revealing, and it captures an exchange between two Boston-based police officers. One officer is basically bragging about hitting with his patrol car Black Lives Matter protesters back in May.
He literally admits he used his vehicle to ram into the protesters.
He says, and I quote, "I was hitting people with the car," and he says it with a certain amount of enthusiasm and relish. And you can see, of course, the other officer walks away and realizes the whole thing has been recorded. As it stands, I think the officer has remained unidentified and has been placed on leave. But I think this video really gets right to the heart, Saeed, of why many people are calling for the police to be defunded. There's no getting around this. And of course, the added dynamic to this is the fact that this officer was running over protesters at a Black Lives Matter protest. It's hard to imagine other groups of
Let's
people.
Let's hear the
really
online reaction
with.
To this, Richard.
Let's go to Mike, first of all, who says, "This is why all law enforcement should have body cams. The fact the officer whose body cam picked it up turned immediately after the bad seed admitted to a crime is an example of the blue wall of silence he immediately knew and the face on the criminal cop." And Stephen says, "Cop brags about hitting protesters with his car and his fellow cops do absolutely nothing. They do worse than nothing. The one with the body cam walks away to cover for him."
All right, we're going to stay in the U.S. We'll move on to your second story. Donald Trump apparently entertaining more anti-democratic paths to preserving his power, although he denies it all.
Incredible stuff. So a meeting which apparently took place on Friday has had White House staffers basically running to the press, apparently because Donald Trump floated and asked questions about the idea of introducing the army and martial law to undergo a second presidential rerun. Apparently Trump was encouraged by former disgraced advisor Michael Flynn. And apparently the chief of staff quickly rebutted the very question, the idea and the notion. But I think the very fact that Donald Trump would even consider talking about using martial law in a White House meeting is quite incredible. And I think it reminds
us... attorney, Rudy Giuliani, rather, tried to dissuade him from doing what he just said. So what have people been saying about this?
Let's go first to Duncan G on Twitter, who says, "Let's hope someone declares Trump mentally unfit before he declares martial law and becomes the dictator he wants to be and why be." Also writes, "Even if Trump imposes martial law in the battleground states that cost Trump the election, the votes have already been certified. Biden won the election and there are no do-overs. martial law, doesn't amend the constitution. At noon on the 21st of January, Biden is president by operation of law. Let's see how that process pans out.
Let's see, like you say. Richard Sedan with those stories. Richard, thank you. And that does it for this London broadcast, everyone.
Rabbi English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to Rabbi English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Rabbi English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on October 12, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with the participants at the joint graduation ceremony held at the Imam Ali Military Academy.
In order to employ logic for the sake of measuring our defensive power, we should see threats the way they are. Enemies conceal their threats in order to launch a surprise attack, and sometimes they magnify the size of threats in order to intimidate nations all over the world. The latter is done by most superpowers. They portray their threats and their powers with more glowing terms in order to force others into retreat. If you can see the real size of the threats, if a nation, country, armed force, and leaders and commanders in that armed force manage to see the correct measures of a threat, and if on the other hand, they see their true capacities, power, and talents, and they succeed in calculating them in the right way, and then organize and deploy them, against them make ready your strength to the utmost of your power, the Holy Quran, chapter 8, verse 60. And finally, if they manage to see the enemy's real threats, then national interests will surely be ensured, and national assets and identity will be preserved.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
If a nation has the defensive power to carry out such a calculation, then politicians and the people in that country feel calm and tranquil, and they will engage in carrying out the duties that are necessary in every country. Therefore, defensive power plays such a role. As I said, rationality means making the correct calculations. we should carry out correct calculations and have a healthy calculation system. This is what rationality means. However, when some people mention reason and rationality, they actually mean feeling afraid. When they say be reasonable, it means be afraid and passive. It means that we should run away in the face of the enemy. This should not be the case. Cowards do not have the right to speak of rationality.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Around the world with reporters.
The Austrian government announces a third hard lockdown starting immediately after Christmas on the 26th of December. Chancellor Sebastian Kurz had promised that the second lockdown, which ended 2 weeks ago, would save Christmas. But that mission has proven to be nearly impossible. Like the majority of nations around the world, Austrians are not expecting a regular Christmas or New Year's Eve. But things don't look entirely bleak, as vaccinations are set to begin across Europe and Austria on the 27th of December. With every week, says Chancellor Kurz, we get a step closer to ending this pandemic.
Measures will become stricter until the seven-day incident is below 100, and in mid-January there will be free mass tests for everyone who wants to take part.
The goal is to keep weekly cases below 100 per 100,000 people. That number currently stands at just under 200. The lockdown is expected to end on January 18th, but only for those who agree to get tested. For those not willing to take the test, the stay-at-home order and curfew will be in place for another extra week. Health Minister Rudolf Anschober expressed concern over the dramatic increase in mortalities across the country over the last 2 months.
With no further measures, at the end of the month, new cases could range between 1,300 and 3,000 cases a day.
For now, the new restrictions mean everyone entering Austria from abroad has to go into a 10-day quarantine, which can only be cut short after 5 days with a negative PCR or antigen test. Over the Christmas holidays, more contacts and therefore more cases are expected, and the latest preventive measures announced by the government are meant to bridge the time until the vaccine can be rolled out in the new year. Homolezki, Vienna.
The coronavirus pandemic has worsened the dire economic conditions in the blockaded Gaza Strip, leaving a huge impact on the livelihoods of people in the tiny coastal enclave. The Israeli blockade in place since 2007 has already caused a sharp decline in the standards of living, as well as alarming levels of unemployment and poverty in the seaside sliver even before the pandemic. Meanwhile, tight lockdown measures to contain COVID-19 have had grave economic implications on all sectors in the Gaza Strip. Experts say the coronavirus pandemic has brought the blockaded enclave's economy to a virtual standstill, driving more Palestinians into poverty.
Economy is a vital lifeline, and the Israeli blockade has crippled this lifeline. The coronavirus restrictions have only worsened the situation. Currently, around 85% of the population live below the poverty line, with an average income of only $2 a day.
Lockdowns are directly affecting thousands of daily wage laborers and their dependents and resulting in suspension of operations in the vast majority of businesses in the Gaza Strip. The coronavirus pandemic has added to the substantial financial strain already felt by many families living in the Gaza Strip.
The coronavirus pandemic has affected economies all over the world. In Gaza, we're suffering the most amid this pandemic because of the ongoing blockade and the lack of resources.
The economy is in a very bad shape, especially during lockdowns, and shops and restaurants are closed. Many businesses had to lay off workers because they can't pay their wages.
The Gaza Strip has logged more than 33,000 coronavirus infections since late August. In an attempt to curb the rapid spread of the deadly virus, local authorities currently impose lockdowns from 6 p.m. until 7 a.m. and a complete curfew on Fridays and Saturdays.
We have imposed lockdowns as part of our preventive measures to slow the spread of the deadly virus. The Ministry of Interior is sparing no effort to minimize the number of coronavirus cases. The number of infections in the Gaza Strip is very high, and we are trying different approaches to contain the virus.
Experts say the pandemic will exacerbate the underlying humanitarian crisis that has gripped Gaza for years.
The COVID-19 pandemic is adding extra strains on Gaza's ailing economy. All economic sectors in the impoverished enclave are already suffering because of the Israeli blockade and multiple wars. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
A nationwide car protest of a Spanish education reform reached Barcelona as the country grappled with a coronavirus pandemic. The procession, organized by a group advocating bilingual teaching in Catalonia, blocked traffic to draw attention to a law that will eliminate Spanish as a vehicular language in education. The reform, known as the Celá law, in reference to Spain's education minister Isabel Celá, was approved by a majority of left-leaning lawmakers in Spain's Congress of Deputies in November. It was hailed as a major breakthrough in promoting equal opportunity in public and concerted schools, increasing funding and access to scholarships, and ending sex segregation. But the main bone of contention is the future of Spanish as a common language across the 17 autonomous regions.
The deadlock over school reform takes special significance here in Catalonia, where the pro-independence movement has been gathering pace. Although Spanish is not the main language in most schools in this autonomous region, opponents of the reform say that consecrating a law that scraps Spanish as the common language ends their hopes for equality and emboldens the separatists.
We want to be free to pick the language that better suits our children in school. We've had enough with the language imposition. They do not allow us to speak Spanish here, or our kids are prohibited from learning in their mother tongue, which is Spanish.
On Thursday, Catalonia's Superior Court of Justice stepped in the debate, arguing that the teaching of Spanish in the region remains, quote, residual, and it urged authorities to teach a minimum 25% of the curriculum in Spanish, in addition to Spanish class. Education officials in Catalonia denounced the move as a breach of regional competencies and vowed to appeal to Spain's higher court.
The regional authorities in Catalonia have long disregarded court rulings. They've always been quick at trampling our freedom as citizens.
Spain's Conservative People's Party, center-right Ciudadanos, and far-right party Vox have so far failed to slow-walk the bill in its journey to final approval in the Senate. Cusay Cadrip, Barcelona.
Being in Pakistan, their hearts are with you.
He's a Noor Dari, a man of Pakistani region. He's heading a London-based anti-Muslim think tank, Islamic Theology of Counterterrorism. Dari is suspected to be sponsored by apartheid state of Israel. Dari, who left Pakistan almost 20 years ago, has been now at the center stage of what Islamabad says, a lingering disinformation campaign propagating that Pakistan is getting ready to normalize ties with Israel.
Pakistan government, they want to establish a relationship with Israel. This is the reason they sent a delegation, and not only the one person, a couple of persons, including the advisor of the prime minister. They flew from the London to Tel Aviv.
The claim was immediately dismissed by Pakistani Prime Minister as baseless.
Why would our delegation visit Israel when we have a policy not to recognize Israel? It is clearly a fake news. In a democratic society like ours, it is unacceptable to normalize ties with Israel because our entire nation stands by Palestinians.
Pakistan has been reportedly under intense pressure from the UAE and Saudi Arabia after some Arab rulers normalized their ties with Israel, notwithstanding the seething public anger in their countries. Both the UAE and Saudi Arabia reportedly threatened Pakistan to expel its an estimated 4 million expatriates if Islamabad resisted their pressure to normalize ties with Israel. This followed a few news anchors who were encouraged by Pakistani military to start debating in favor of normalizing ties with Israel, an allegation denied by army known for calling shots in country's foreign policy making. The media outlets in the apartheid state even find it hard to speak with a credible Pakistani journalist.
Many Pakistani journalists would even decline to appear and speak with me, speaking with from our studio in Tel Aviv.
Pakistani journalists who spoke recently with the Israeli news channel are either tainted with the corruption charges or had desperation to come into limelight through controversies. Anyone supporting Israel in Pakistan meets with instant condemnation at social and mainstream media, given Israel's unending mass killing of Palestinians and their forcible expulsion from the Muslim Holy Land from 1948 to onwards. The major thrust of the argument of the lobbies working for Israel and its allies has been to cite Arab countries abandoning Arab nationalism in occupied Palestine for an independent Palestinian state. However, theologists point out that forcing Israel to withdraw from Islamic Holy Land is not an Arab cause, but in fact it is a greater cause of Muslim nationalism beyond color, creed, and geography, something which overwhelmingly prevails in Pakistan. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
In a rare case, the second in Yemen in the past 3 years, a pair of conjoined twins were born in a Sabaeen hospital in Yemeni capital Sana'a. The two children are in critical condition and need to be treated outside the country, which is impossible due to the continued siege and the closure of Sana'a airport to the Yemenis.
This is a tragedy that children in Yemen suffer as a result of aggression, blockade, and the use of internationally prohibited weapons as well as malnutrition. In the case of the Siamese twins and congenital deformations, the biggest problem is that we cannot send them abroad to have surgery, so their lives are at risk.
The director of the Health Bureau called on the United Nations and the World Health Organization to send a plane to transport the two children or to send a medical team to conduct the surgery inside Yemen, where devastated and under-resourced health services cannot offer any help to these children.
I'm the father of the twins, and their condition is critical, and they need to receive medical care and surgery outside the country because the health situation in Yemen is collapsing and Sana'a airport is still closed.
Infants suffer a difficult situation in Yemen, and the absence of essential medical supplies and healthcare facilities needed for their survival and well-being. Yemen health services have been in a dire situation since the start of the Saudi-led war on the country in 2015.
With the fast approaching of the new year, the Sana'a airport remains closed to sick children and women, causing the loss of many lives. The airport is open to United Nations airplanes only. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Local elections in Indian-administered Kashmir held in 8 phases have come to an end. The voting process has remained by and large peaceful amid stringent security measures. After the revocation of Kashmir's special status, regional political parties had refused to participate in the electoral process as a sign of protest against India's decision to strip Kashmir of its autonomous status. That resulted in the strengthening of the Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party in the Muslim-majority region.
However, this time, the regional parties formed an alliance to take part in the local elections. Compared to the past, a large number of people came forth to cast their ballots, and many of